43.8 million adults experience mental illness in any given year. That's one in five adults. That's a lot of people. Half of those are chronic illnesses that start by the age of 14, three quarters by 24. Today we are joined by Penelope, who is the mother of three children, including Donald. Penelope Rodriguez, co-author with her son Donald of Homeostasis, The Journey of a Manic Depressive. Welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Penelope, tell us a little bit about Donald.
Donald was an introvert, super into hockey, a good student in high school. Felt like he needed something to help him focus, medication to help him focus, which we didn't do initially. And then he went to college, and he got into a Boston University, was a pre-med student, was away a lot of the time, and had those similar needs. He's a really smart kid, very inquisitive, and we didn't really have any notion that we were going to be having any problems until he came home after college. And today he's doing well. He's stable. He has bipolar 1, but it is managed. And the book is about a journey that we had to go through to get to that point.
What's interesting, at the beginning of Homeostasis, which is largely written by Donald, he says that the worst part, and I am now quoting him, he says the worst part about being manic is that you can't understand what's happening to your mind or realize the impact of your behavior until you do something that harms you or someone around you. When were you first aware that there was really something that was going on with your son?
New York to have New Year's Eve party. And we allowed him to do that again after he graduated. That was his Christmas gift. On his way home, he sent me this text, just absolutely effusive and gushing about how wonderful we were. He was crying with happiness about how awesome his family was. He just now was realizing it. And remember, this is a kid who said almost, he was very little use of words, and so he was going on and on, and I was just happy that he was happy. But his older sister read that same text and said, "Oh my gosh, he looks like he's on the high of a bipolar state," and I just dismissed it, thinking she was being unfairly critical of her younger brother, because that's what siblings do. And when he got home, we were talking, and he talked an awful lot, and he actually called me up at work, which this is a child who swore up and down that his phone could not make phone calls. It could only be used for texting. And so I get this phone call, and mom, the world is falling apart. I can't understand why everyone is just not doing anything. Why? And we're not to this family. So I get that part of it, but he was just really upset. And then he called his brother in tears. His brother lives in New York, and David is younger, so he's got sister, brother, David. And he was in tears. He said, "I don't know what's wrong with my mind. I have all these ideas. They're racing. I can't get anything under control." And so then that was when my husband is a physician, and I said, "Okay, we've got to do something. This kid is not okay." But on the other hand, Donald was so happy that he was no longer depressed, because he'd been suffering through depression through college, which I thought it was situational, because that's how he presented it to his family physician. But he was so happy not to be depressed that part of him was really thrilled once he realized how much energy he had and how much he could think and how his mind felt like it was being used to its fullest capacity, that getting him to get help was a real interesting challenge. And he just basically said, "Well, fine, I'll do it because of you, but understand I'm perfectly fine and I like where I'm at." And so then there began our challenge of actually getting him into the mental health care system, which took some doing.
Well, and one of the challenges with certainly with bipolar is that during the manic episode, a lot of times that feeling, that can feel so good that the individual doesn't want to feel differently. They do think that that's really just fine.
And that's exactly right. And in fact, Donald does say in the book that he's seen everyone around me was freaking out, and I was having the time of my life. I could not figure out what their problem was. And he said, I had to make a really tough decision. Do I compromise my happiness and get help to make them happy, or do I make them upset, meaning everybody else, and stay with what I'm doing? Because clearly we were not going to agree on this. And it took, in fact, we started, he did agree to go to a psychiatrist. That did not go well. The first one we found was not a good match. And that's really important. You've got to find someone that you know, whoever you're talking about, can really connect with, who there's mutual respect and ability to really make an effort to make a change and recognize that you need to make a change.
Let me ask you this. Let's back up a little bit, because you said that he was going to school. What year was he in when he had what, in hindsight, now seems like it might have been a first break for him?
For a manic break, I have no idea. Depression started probably when he first began school, because he loaded himself up on doing way too much. He couldn't do it all. He got behind. He was pre-med, so he felt like he had to have a perfect GPA. That, of course, did not happen first semester. My mother died that first second year, and David was very close to her, and broke up with his girlfriend from high school. So all kinds of things were snowballing, and so he was taking Adderall to help him focus. He was taking Prozac to help calm him down and feel better. He's then taking Trazodone to help him sleep.
None of it worked.
And
he was getting prescriptions for these different medications.
Oh, yeah, he was. And you see, a physician can only do in response to whatever a patient is telling them.
Right.
And I'm sure that Donald was not, you know, he was telling her things that he thought he needed to tell her. And they also may have been true. But when you look at them separately, you come up with the diagnosis of ADHD, you come up with a diagnosis situational depression, never once dreaming, and this is the problem for diagnosing bipolar, never once dreaming that really the overarching disease state here was bipolar. And the treatment is completely different. And so if you don't know that, you're giving this kid medication that's actually going to exacerbate the problem, not ameliorate it. And that's what happened.
So he was taking Adderall for ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he was taking what else?
Prozac for situational depression.
Okay.
And Trazodone to sleep, because he wasn't sleeping, he couldn't focus. He was overwhelmed with school, and because he was taking on too much, he was in a fraternity, he was playing club hockey, he was taking pre-med courses, and he had just approached college in the exact wrong way. And much of what he needed to do too involved getting counseling. Whenever you're taking a medication for regards to your disease, you also should be having counseling to help monitor your lifestyle behaviors and so forth, because there's a lot you can do that does not involve the medication part of it that will help you live a better and happier life.
Exactly.
And help you manage your symptoms. That was not going to happen. Donald made it very clear, I do not have time. And I'm thinking, hey, well, that's fascinating. But he was so far away, I really couldn't see what was going on. I only knew, again, what he would tell me. And I also learned later on that he and some friends, this is where having science major kids can be scary, because they try and solve problems they have no business addressing. They created a homemade it's a shock therapy treatment, basically. They thought they could shock their minds and be more brilliant.
Oh, no.
Well, no. And they had engineer friends help them build it. And then everyone gathered around to see what would happen. I'm sitting at home thinking, I can't believe you're telling me this. Don't. But he did. And nothing happened except some singed hair. No one was smarter. No one felt better. But they all were alive. That was good. So he really was trying everything he could think of to try and get his head on straight, because it just wasn't working for him, and he knew it. But he was trying to hide it because he didn't want anybody to know. It wasn't what pre-meds do. You sucked it up. You did your work. You went on. And so much of this was hidden, because we didn't see him that often. He would text, whatever, but that was it.
How old was he at this point?
He would have been 19 to 22.
Okay. And the counseling services available at school, he certainly wasn't going to access that.
No, and I'm sure they were fabulous, but he wasn't going to. And that's really too bad because, and that's really what's recommended before you get any kind of ADHD medication. Try the counseling first to see if you can manage your symptoms without the medication. Because as David pointed out later, he said, Adderall is great at helping you focus, but it also doesn't mean you're going to focus on what you want to focus on. I wound up focusing on the things that were making me depressed. That just made me that much worse. And so it's really something that has to be approached in a very integrative way.
Let me just interrupt you for a second because you're going back and forth between Donald and David. We're talking
Oh,
about
I'm
this.
sorry.
We're talking about the same person, yes? Okay. Okay.
We are.
All right. So, Donald's in school between 19 and 22. You don't really know what's going on. You only know what he's telling you, and he's not being really forthcoming in ways that would get any one person aware of all of what's happening in his life.
Correct. And part of it is I believe as the youngest child and the son of a physician whose grandfather is a physician, whose uncle is a physician, whose cousin wants to be a physician, he really felt like he had to measure up and show that he could do what needed to be done. And so admitting to any kind of perceived weakness was just not going to happen.
So he really felt for him what was the burden of the family legacy almost.
It was, but it also was a self-imposed burden
Sure.
because neither his father nor I have ever said you need to go to medical school. We, in fact, have asked all of our kids to please follow your bliss. You find what you love to do in life, and that's what you need to do. But it's amazing what kids or an adult's minds will do when they decide a certain thing and run with it, and when they believe that's all they can do.
That's very true. Now, at one point, your son went to Alaska. What was that about?
That's sort of the pinnacle of the story. Donald had reached a point here where he wasn't taking his meds, here being Minnesota, not taking his meds. He had friends coming to celebrate his birthday, his 23rd birthday. We're a hockey family. We love our Minnesota Wild, and we were having an outdoor game against our rivals, the Chicago Blackhawks. So the friends are coming to see David because they were worried about him, frankly. And go to this game with him. He was taking, and I'm guessing he got this from the internet, medication that truck drivers or people who have nighttime jobs take to stay awake. And he basically stayed up for almost 2 weeks in preparation for these friends to visit.
What do you mean, medication
That
he got from the internet?
I don't remember the name of it, but there's a medication that truck drivers will take just to kind of prevent themselves from falling asleep at the wheel.
And did he literally
And so,
order it online?
yes, he did. And so he was basically keeping himself up almost 24/7 for several days. And it did a huge number on his mind and on his heart rate. And he was spiraling up into from hypomania to mania and then moving into severe mania. He's becoming delusional. He believed he was God. He believed he's written this novel that he was escaping to Alaska for to not be known. He wanted to kind of be this famous author who was wanted to get off the grid. And he also believed that he was being stalked on Facebook, when in fact it was me saying, "Please do not post anything more because you will destroy your life. Stop now." And so he wasn't going to come home. His friends could not stand him anymore. His roommates did not want him around anymore. And so he'd asked my nephew, who he really has the utmost respect for, if he could come up and work with him in his brewery. And so I contacted my family in Alaska, and they said, "Yeah, we that's fine." None of us knew really to the extent that David McDonald was where he was headed. We really had no idea because we'd never been there before. We didn't know what was ahead. We just knew what had been behind us. So he went up, and within 24 hours, I got a phone call from my brother-in-law saying, "Donald picked a fight at the brewery, stole my son-in-law's truck. He was missing. We can't find him." And both my husband and I said, "Please call the police," thinking, okay, finally we've got an opportunity to get him into a psych ward. And when the police caught up with Donald, he appeared to be normal,
Okay,
very calm. And
let me ask you a question. You've
sure.
said you just said finally we have an opportunity to get him into a psych ward. You couldn't get him into a psych ward before?
No, he's an adult. I could hardly make an appointment, let alone commit him anywhere.
So talk
He
about
and I
that.
thought,
Talk about that.
okay, it was. It's well, first, it's very frustrating, and because no one who is having bouts of mental illness or symptoms of mental illness is necessarily going to have the wherewithal or the inclination to seek help, especially if they're manic. And so, when I tried calling various psychiatrists around the metropolitan area, and it's a large seven-county metropolitan area in Minnesota, out of Twin Cities, most of the practices were closed to new patients. Others had a very long wait, and so others said, "Absolutely not. He's got to make that appointment." And so that's how we pulled some strings on our end, having referred a lot of our patients to, we have an endocrinology clinic, referred a lot of our patients to a psychiatrist that we got him to really see David and start the ball rolling there. But I couldn't do anything. He was an adult.
So how old
And
was he at that
so
point?
he would have been 23 at that point.
23. All right. So at 23, he's your son. You know that there's something up, but because he's an adult, there's nothing that you as a parent can do.
No, we have to wait until he either is a harm to himself, a harm to others, or is disabled in some way, shape, or form.
So when you get the
And
call from Idlaska, you're thinking, finally, we can get him to a hospital.
exactly. And then yet when the police encountered him, he had calmed down, and when they were interviewing him about what he'd done, there was nothing they could do, or if they did, he would be put in jail, not in the psych ward. And so my brother-in-law declined. He said, "No, that's not our intent. We need to get him some help." And so then I went up, and all smiles, of course, he'll do whatever I want him to do. Yes, he'll go back on his meds. Yes, he'll come live at home. And then the next day, that didn't happen. In terms of his attitude, and he was getting more and more aggressive, more delusional, and I just had to get him back home to get treatment somehow. And meanwhile, that night, we were so sick of him, my sister and I, and he asked to go for a walk. We said, "Please go for your walk." Now, granted, this is Alaska in February. It's dark. There's some Christmas lights hanging around, but there was not a lot of means to find a way around where, because she lives on the side of a mountain. And after we thought he'd wander around inside and then he'd come back in. So later on, we started texting him saying, "Come on back in, supply cards." He didn't answer. And so after 2 hours, my sister called the search and rescue team, or the police first, and then they got the search and rescue team in because no one could find him. And it turns out he was following voices coming through his watch telling him what he should be doing, and he had all different kinds of things going on in his head, all of which were driving him up the side of the mountain
Literally.
at a rapid pace, literally and rapidly, a rapid pace. That kid made good time. And he but he got to the top of the mountain, and maybe 3 or 4,000 feet, and dead silence, no phone service, and he basically realized he was screwed. And so
Penelope,
had to figure out to
I'm going to
go
interrupt
ahead.
you because we need to take a break, but when we come back, we will pick up right here.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Penelope Rodriguez, mother of Donald Rodriguez. They have co-written Homeostasis, The Journey of a Manic Depressive. We'll be back in a moment. Penelope, we're talking about your son, Donald, and what you've described. I really want the listeners to have a clear picture of what was going on. You were both in Alaska. You were with a family member. He had gone out to take a walk. Now, it's Alaska. It's dark out. And he had been gone for 2 hours. Is that correct? Just walking around?
Correct, yeah. And the reason we actually found out where he went was he went to a neighbor's of my sister's and knocked on the door. And people in Alaska who live on the side of the mountain don't typically have guests at 9 o'clock at night. And the guy got his shotgun and scared Donald off, and then called my sister saying, "We've got this prowler in the neighborhood." And my sister said, "No, that's actually my nephew. We're trying to find him." So we kind of knew where to start looking. And then it took another 14 hours in order to find him.
14 hours?
14 hours he was gone.
And he's out wandering, and you said he went up a mountain?
They live on the side of a mountain, and he climbed all the way up to the peak, top of it, and went over the other side down into the valley. Now, I will stop by here by saying he has a human physiology major. So his mind was working well enough to remember a lot of what he was taught, and he employed a lot of the techniques and need for survival that he learned based on that science major. And that truly is what kept him alive, because he thought of different ways to keep himself warm by shaking and finding cover and so forth, actually urinating on his hands to keep him from freezing. So he did different things that would help him survive, but he didn't believe he would. He's pretty sure he's going to die alone.
What was the temperature?
It was about 10 degrees. Pretty warm for Alaska at that time of year, but it was 10 degrees, and he was shedding clothing as he was getting warmer from hypothermia.
So it was 10 degrees above or below?
Oh, I'm sorry, above, yes.
10 degrees above, but as he was getting hypothermia, he was actually taking clothes off.
Correct.
So you must have been, I mean, those 14 hours, I can't imagine what that was like for you and your sister.
It was gut-wrenching, and I'm the kind of person that does not believe something awful has happened until it's absolutely stared at my face. So I believed that they would find him. I had no idea it was going to take that long, obviously. And it was just a moment of complete disbelief. You just think, I can't even comprehend. And the beautiful thing about the search and rescue team in Alaska is they are very talented, very well-trained, very persistent, and they finally got their helicopter out, and because they had dogs looking for him, and they could not find him anything. And then they got a helicopter out looking the next morning, early the next morning. And you got to remember, it's dark for a long time up there, and doesn't get light until very late morning. And that's when they were doing a wider search, and they finally he saw them, and they saw him, and they connected that he was. It was a very long and awful time, and I had to call his father and say, "Well, not sure where our son is."
I can't imagine those 14 hours for you, for your husband when he got that information, for your son, what was going on in his mind as he's out there trying to stay alive but not believing that he would make it.
Well, what's going on in his mind is he and what kind of kept him going was this, again, being delusional. By now he was psychotic, I guess, if you want to use the progression of things. He believed that there was going to be a great party for him back at the hockey rink, and that his ex-girlfriend was behind all of this effort to test him to see if he's prepared for NASA, to test him to help him raise money for his startup he wanted to get going. And if he could just survive, he would be able to go back to this party and be with everybody, and it would be great. So it also was part of this delusional thinking that kept him going. And obviously fear played a major role, but it both occupied his brain, and the hope of seeing everybody again and believing that he would helped him stay the course and reveal himself so that the rescue people could find him.
So it's interesting how the psychotic thinking both harmed him and helped him.
Exactly. So and we try to describe it in the book, and because if you read it in the book, it's so disjointed, and we left it that way simply because that was how his mind was functioning.
Yeah.
And it's just a mesh of complexities. And Donald has this real affinity for movies, which are a recurring theme throughout the book. And I finally sat down and watched these movies and thought, oh my gosh, I had just done this before. I would have recognized this, and this. And they literally, the different things were driving him to do the different things that he did. He believed he was in a movie.
I want to go backwards for a second before Alaska. One of the things that you talk about in your portion of the book is that his friends they kept wanting you to get him hospitalized, and your hands were tied. You were not able to do that. And I'm sure that being a part of the medical profession yourself, not only did you understand why you couldn't, but it would have to be that much more frustrating. You're seeing both sides of the coin. What was that like for you? On the one hand, his friends are saying, get him some help. You're his mother. You don't want to do anything but get him help, but you know that you...
It's extremely frustrating. It revealed to me a side of medicine that I hadn't really been aware of. And now I'm a strong advocate. I was furious. I thought to myself, how can this possibly be? And on the one hand, I wanted to conjure up some kind of situation where I could call the police and say, oh, he's doing this, you got to ring them. At the same time, I wanted to be very sure that he would go where he needed to go. And I tried to explain to his friends and the friends' parents, why aren't you doing this? Why did you get him to the hospital? Why didn't you take advantage of any opportunity that came your way? Well, you know, you're not walking in my shoes, first of all. And second of all, if you honestly think I hadn't done so if I could have, you know, you're sadly mistaken. It is, all I could do is feel for anybody who had family who had mental illness or on the streets, which a majority of them, I think, do, who don't or can't get help. You're standing by and watching something completely implode, and there's nothing you can do about it, nothing. Because it's all about patient protection. And that's lovely, but there comes a point when you've got to say, hey, what about patient safety and patient care? And that's where the two concepts collide.
Let's go back to Alaska. They finally find your son, and they bring him back to your sister's house, or do they take him immediately to the hospital?
No, I would have been happier if they'd taken me to the hospital. They brought him back to my sister's house. And so we had this, if you can imagine, this big fire truck rolling up the mountainside into the driveway. And they froze him from the knees down. He walks right past me, doesn't even see me. Goes to my brother-in-law, gives him a hug. They get him inside, get him into a shower. And the police officers there were absolutely fabulous. They said, this is what I've had. But a person with bipolar behaves like, here's what's going on. And I knew a lot of it by then, but they were the first people who were professionals that actually took the time to say, here's what you can expect. Here are some things you can do. Here's some places you can look. Nobody had done that up to that point. And so we're busy having David take a shower, and I'm thinking, oh God, hurry up. I want to get you out of here into that psych ward. And they're saying, take your time, you know, just let him be and so forth. And I'm thinking, no, there's going to be a loophole that he will get through if we do not get this done right now. And so that's what I'm thinking. I certainly did not say that. And finally, he gets done, he gets clothes on, and they, you know, put cuffs on and put him in the car, and then take him off to the emergency psych ward in Anchorage. And David O'Donnell thought, well, you know, they're bringing me in because, you know, I've got hypothermia, they got to check me out. And so he didn't really understand why he was going to the emergency room. And even more surprised when it was in the psych ward. And could not contact me. We were not able to go see him either, which I did not realize was going to happen. And so he really felt abandoned. And we did not have that intention, but he was not happy about that. At the same time, you know, he began to realize why he was there and answered questions correctly and got his medication. So he was beginning to be stabilized enough to get him home. And then from there, I had to try to navigate the system in Minnesota.
And the reason for keeping you away from him, what was that? What did the hospital say about that?
Typically, I guess in lockdown, they want to get and assess the patient to see where they're at and to get medication started. I honestly don't know, because when he checked himself into a local ER and then psych ward in St. Paul, I brought him in. He asked me to bring him, and I did. We were with him in the ER the entire time. Then he went up to Venture Bob to the lock unit, and there were visitation hours. But I think it's just kind of get an assessment and get that patient stabilized as best as possible before taking the next step. And honestly, Donald probably could have called me. He didn't realize you have to dial the area code even when you're out of state to okay. have your phone work. So,
how long was he in the hospital in Alaska?
24 hours.
Okay. And then he was you brought him home?
Yes, and if anybody's flown between Anchorage and St. Paul, it's typically a six-hour flight, and I now had, fortunately, had tailwinds and was 4.5 hours rest, but he couldn't sit still. He was getting up and walking around all the time, and he was aware of what he was doing. And we only were, the hospital checked him out with only the medication I had brought up, the Abilify that he hadn't used yet. So we had maybe 6 pills. And they didn't give us anything when he left because they said you need to follow up with your own psychiatrist and get your medications there. We cannot do that. So I'm flying with this child who I hope will make it back. And then we bring him back to Minnesota. And fortunately, I was able to get a referral to a nurse, psychiatric nurse practitioner, because I really couldn't find any services that were available in our area. And I called our family physician and asked if she could refer him to an outpatient program through our health system. And she said, no, his incident didn't happen in Minnesota. None of us saw him. So therefore, you know, something else happened. So there's this urgent care center for mental health that you can take him to if something else happens. I nearly lost it. I could not believe we had to wait for yet another incident before we could get him into treatment in Minnesota. I wasn't going to stay in Alaska and do it. So fortunately, because I know the healthcare system, I held on to that referral and said, we'll find somebody else. And so he had an appointment with the nurse practitioner the next day, got him in, started to get him stabilized to a certain point. But then when he really, really took a nosedive in his depression, and she referred Donald to her psychiatrist supervisor, and that's who we've been working with ever since, and she's been amazing.
All right. Now, you said earlier on that the first doctor who you were able to get your son in to see was not a good fit. What was the challenge with the first psychiatrist?
Well, there were two. He is of old school, very authoritarian, very stoic, not a personality that Donald was going to respond to on a good day. And here you have a child who's manic, who thinks she knows everything and is going to challenge you at every round. Now, I expected that person to have experience handling somebody with David's, at that point, obnoxious personality. That didn't happen. Also, you know, he, out of the goodness of his heart, added Donald to his roster, and because he had a close practice, and he wasn't going to be in town. So there was a long gap of about a month between when he initially saw Donald and when he would follow up with him, which is absolutely not going to work when you're trying to start a regimen. And he had Donald touch base with them 2 weeks after he started taking medication, and recommended taking it at night, not during the day. And medication, even in a low dosage, was very, it was tough for Donald to handle. It made him very lethargic. His mind was slowing down. He couldn't think. He hated it. And so between the personality differences and the difficulty in pulling someone who is manic in, because they are difficult to handle. They really think they know everything, and if they're God's gift to the world, you probably can't help them find their way home. And yet, I believe someone with that level, because he's got to be in his early 60s, I believe he would have enough experience to navigate that, and he didn't.
Well, it's just interesting to hear you say that he took someone into his, I mean, you know, from the outside looking in, you just don't know, but it's interesting to hear you say that you know, this was a seasoned clinician who took someone who was bipolar into his practice, knowing that he was going to be on vacation in a couple of weeks, and so wouldn't have been able to monitor him appropriately. I assume he had somebody back covering for him in his absence?
Didn't mention him to us if he did. We had no idea. And so that, I looking back, I just realized that was a huge, huge mistake. I mean, he was basically doing us a favor. He wanted to see if this mental state was caused by drug use or if it was caused by true mental illness. And again, either way, you have to be present to see. And so he was waiting for lab results and so forth, and concluded that Donald had much of the personality problems were caused by use of marijuana, and he was actually on his way down and so forth. And Donald said, look, my dog just died. He'd had a bestie dog for a month. I have the flu, and I'm not, this isn't right. And so he said, I'm not going back to see him. I'm sorry. I did my part, and I'm not doing it. So we were stuck with what we had.
And because of his age, you couldn't force him.
Oh, no, I couldn't. I absolutely couldn't. All I could do is stay close by and not alienate him. And that, in my mind, is very key for parents or other family members who are caring for someone with bipolar. Do not sever the communication in any way, shape, or form, and ignore it. If they say hateful things to you, whatever they say to you, it's not acceptable, obviously. It's their disease talking, if you will. And as long as you can keep the communication open, you've got a fighting chance of sneaking in and capitalizing on an opportunity when it presents itself, and you have got to be watching for those opportunities.
What was it like for your household dealing with the fact that you had a child, you had other children, dealing with the fact that you had a child who was so ill and your hands were tied in terms of getting him the help that you knew he needed?
Our daughter was living, where was she then? She was in California. And our son is in New York, which maybe tells you something about our family. they have large personalities. They need their space. And actually, it's not true. Our daughter did come back home for a while. It was really interesting in that, and they're all adults. So my daughter would have been 28, or son, other son was 25 at the time. Donald's brother basically blocked him from making any phone calls. He would not accept his phone calls because Donald was texting him and calling him all the time, and it was interfering with his work. And he also became very angry with Donald when Donald claimed that this whole last previous year of he'd been planning to this whole bipolar act just to show that everybody did love each other and that they'd come together at the end and the differences would be gone and so forth. It was all BS, but his brother was furious and didn't talk to him for a long time. His sister became very impatient because she was working on a PhD and Donald kept wandering into a room and wanted to talk to her, and she finally had to find ways to keep him out and so forth. And she was working hard on her stuff, and here is this kid who's constantly interfering with her life and her way of being and so forth and her ability to study, and he was driving her absolutely nuts. Eventually, when he came out of the manic state and started going down into depression, she could identify with that because she'd suffered from depression herself. And so that part she could understand and be empathetic with and help him with. But until he got to that point, she was beside herself. And my husband took things quite personally. And ironically, he was the one who taught me how to handle my mother, who had died from complications of dementia. I was caring for her. And he taught me how to deal with her outbursts and deal with things she had to say and so forth. And they were beautiful tricks that he taught me. He was unable to draw upon those himself when it became very personal with him. And so I said, you know what, I love you and support Donald and so forth, but I'm going to let you handle him because I'm just making things worse and I do not want to do that. So I'll be sounding board for you. I will support you any way I can, but I will not be the one that's going to interact with him. You are doing a really good job of that. You will probably be the one who needs to do that. So that fell on my shoulders.
So
in some ways that was, it was a burden, but in other ways it was a relief because then I knew I could, if anybody messed up, it was going to be me, but I also knew I didn't have to factor in any other approach. I could just do what I needed to do.
It's interesting that each family member took his or her own place in terms of dealing with Donald. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Penelope, co-author of Homeostasis. Don't go away. In families where there's mental illness, either the parents blame themselves for the fact of the illness, and or the siblings, if there are any, begin to worry that they're going to have the same illness. Did any of that happen in your family?
I'll start by saying that bipolar is quite often has some genetic connection. There was never really any blame. I think there was, for Donald's brother, he believed that he had a much milder version of it because he experiences depression during certain times of the year and he's really productive other parts of the year and so forth, but not enough to see or believe he had full-blown bipolar 1 disorder. Sister sometimes felt like she might have some symptoms as well, but not in a way that would be fearful or blaming. I think it made them both, the siblings, much more aware of their own emotional well-being, their own mental and emotional tendencies, and to find better ways to take care of themselves so that they could get a better handle on healthy living as well. And so that actually turned out to be a positive thing. And I'll say the same thing with the Donald and I did a lot of working and reading together. I would go to all the psychiatrist appointments. I accompanied him a couple of times to therapy when it was appropriate. I went once myself to the same therapist on Donald's ticket, so to speak, to learn how we as a family could be more supportive of him and each other. And so through all this, Donald and I learned an awful lot of coping mechanisms, ways to really care for ourselves in a holistic way that would enhance our health all the way around. And we both still follow those things. And we never would have happened upon them had we not had to go through this process of learning how to address a mental illness and how to make lifestyle changes to accommodate the symptoms and lessen them.
When you say lifestyle changes, can you give us an example of some of the lifestyle changes that your family employed?
Well, I'm not saying our entire family did, but most of us did. I'm smiling because in my previous life, I did a lot of medical writing for Mayo Clinic, and it seemed like every time I wrote about, didn't matter what disease state, part of the recovery or treatment was going to involve physical activity and nutrition, and mental health is no different. The three kids and I all use some form of meditation. Two of us use yoga, and we're all physically active. And on most days we eat pretty well. Donald and I both add supplements that were recommended by a therapist to our diet, just to kind of help keep our minds and bodies and spirits, because it really has to be a holistic approach. You can't just say, oh, Harry meds, go do your thing. You really have to say, okay, how can I make my whole body feel better and respond better? And the physical activity is a very key point as well. And so I walk our dogs, and I do yoga. Donald is now working at a hockey school and as an analytics coordinator and coach. And so he works out with an NHL trainer and is certainly put through his paces. He's actually lost 40 pounds in the last year through that work and through better eating habits. And ironically, it's through that eating I can figure out if Donald is slipping into more of a downtime or as he puts it, days of laziness. When I see Domino's and Papa John's and Chipotle pop up on his bank debit statement, I say, oh, he's not feeling so good anymore. And I'll go just kind of check on him, say, hey, you know, how's it going? And he says, oh, no, I'll be okay. Just give me a few days. I'll be back on my feet. I'll get back to my better habits. So I can use food as a way of indicating, okay, who's feeling good, who's down on themselves. And it's kind of, I never thought that would be the case, but it really is a holistic approach is all I can say.
Many times when there is an illness of any kind in the family, physical or mental, it can really put a strain on a marriage. How did you and your husband navigate through these very challenging waters?
I think when we established our roles, and I'm sure there are those who would question why we chose the roles we did, but those roles worked for us. As long as we could talk to each other and I could keep my husband apprised of what was going on and also kind of give him tools to not antagonize Donald, but also as he's going through depression, just ways for him to be present and encourage him and really be supportive. And then for between him and me, my husband and me, it was all about the communication. And he was then somebody I could talk to and say, hey, this is going on, and I'm really struggling with this, or here's why I'm doing this, and here's where we're at with things. But truly, I think writing this book was probably one of the best ways of accomplishing a lot of different things on a lot of different levels. It was therapy for us, both Donald and me, as it turns out. It also, when I had the rest of the family read the book, gave them insight as to what was going on and help them understand all of us. And that way we could have meaningful conversations if they needed to occur. There's a lot more understanding involved, but the writing itself was a way to express how we felt, what we thought, what actually happened, how we saw each other's things happening. It was Donald who suggested to me, like, why don't you write your part of it? Because I bet nobody thought about what does it mean to be a parent of someone like me. And the whole reason we did the book the way we did it was because we were looking for information to try and learn about what does it mean to have bipolar, what does it mean to the family, how do we treat it, how do we live. There were no books that we could find that had the voice of a young, just post-adolescent male, which is typically when this disease is starts, is not necessarily when it's diagnosed, but it's when it starts. The book was written almost in real time, so whoever reads it can see as it's happening how it's all evolving. So it's very current, it's very real. And the parenting part of it is, you know, as a parent, I was looking for support and ideas and help and so forth, and I have basically had to create them myself. Or Dave, Donald and I working together, finding that we both really, really went through Amazon and Google to find as many resources that were credible, we felt, that would help us learn, because we really didn't know. And some things really scared us both. Donald was sure his life was over and he realized what he perceived to be the limitations on his life were going to be. And each person is different, so you're going to respond differently. But when you're reading one person's point of view, you think, oh my God, that's going to happen. And it may or may not, but it really forced him to evaluate what his dreams were going to be. And once he did that, he could then come to grips better with what he was going to be facing for the years to come.
And in a lot of ways, I think it does what you both wanted it to do, which is to provide a sense of hope, and that a diagnosis is a diagnosis. It's not the end of your world.
You're absolutely right. And I actually went so far as to track down a now resident who had discovered she had bipolar when she was in medical school. And we talked about what happened, what it meant, what kind of support she got. And then I shared that with Donald and said, you know, you can pursue this if you absolutely really want to, but you have to know it's going to require a complete commitment. Or you can say, what else can I do? And the bottom line is you are in charge to a certain extent, and you determine how you are, how you get treatment. You determine how well you follow it. You really aren't, your life is not out of control, and you still have plenty you can aspire to do. And so basically Donald is returning to his original dream, which was to be play hockey. He's not playing it, but he's involved with players who are professional, and he's helping figure out who can go on and do what, and he loves it. And he has all kinds of interests, and he's discovering that this disease is not limiting him. His only concern is he said, I'm a jack of all trades and master of none. And I said, well, all three of you are like that. You're interested in lots of different things. And so that's the beauty of your mind. Yes, that does create some problems, and you will figure out what to do with them. But be grateful that you have so many things that you think would be cool, because if you're stuck in a rut and can't do anything, then you just aren't going to go anywhere. And so that is the bottom line. And that's why I kept trying to find things like BP Hope, things that would give Donald inspiration, say, yeah, I can get through this. I can if I just hold on.
And what about Donald's social life? Is he hanging out with his friends? What's he doing?
That is a struggle at this point. His current friends, some are still very leery because of the manic episodes. And part of it is he, if anybody who has gone away to college and then comes home, it's very hard to reestablish the friendships that you had with your high school friends in some extent, because you have now have broader interests. You don't really care who's getting drunk on the weekend and what the basketball floor is.
Right.
You don't.
Right.
And so right now he's trying to establish new friendships with people who have interests that more, that better match his. He does stay in touch with his friends from college and goes out to see them from time to time, and that's been really helpful. He enjoys working with his buddies at the hockey school and so forth. His challenge is finding people who will challenge him and who will allow him to challenge them. I think his problem with his high school friends is that it was part of him challenging them that was indicative of his manic behavior. And so they're like, oh, I don't do this anymore. Plus, they're not necessarily interested in all the topics that he is. We're a very much an engaged political family, and we love to read. We're voracious readers. And we pursue all kinds of media sources, no fake news, and but finding someone with whom you can have a conversation and really debate is a challenge, and that's what he's trying to figure out, because he's also 24. He can't go out and party. He doesn't want to go out and party.
Yeah.
And so to try and kind of bridge that gap is what he's trying to do right now, actually. He says, Mom, you know, I love you, but I'm bored. And I want to go out on my own and take my little dog with me. And he said, but I've got to find some ways to develop other friendships. And I want to go back out east where my buddies are, because we all do understand each other. And they saw me as well, but they understand and they're supportive. And we have so many things in common. So I'm working toward that. I said, that's fabulous. You just keep what I'm doing. Just make sure you can pay for it.
There you go. Is he continuing in therapy?
Absolutely. And it's interesting, because he has such a high and such a low, he is very aware of any movement in either direction. And will check in with me, will check in with his therapist to say, okay, I'm feeling really good, is that okay? Or I'm starting to feel a little low, what should I do? And his therapist is, I cannot say enough about him, he's absolute godsend and can fit Donald in whenever he needs to be, because he has such amazing hours. It's not he's got a full practice, but he has real flexible hours. And so Donald will contact him whenever he thinks he needs to, and it's usually every couple of weeks, and then he may go 2 or 3 months and say, oh, no, I need to regroup and kind of refresh my skills. So he goes back, and they really the therapist really helps Donald stay on track.
That's wonderful. And what about medication?
Absolutely got the medication going on. He takes a generic form of Lamictal. It's called Motrigine, and that's pretty much it. The doses have gone up just a little bit, and but it's been hovering at the same amount for quite some time. And again, it's psychiatrists, it's fabulous too. She, her whole staff, whenever you call and say, "Oh, I need this," they figure out a way to make it happen, which is really unusual because they're all also overworked. So that has helped him really stay stable. And the other thing I'll make a plug for is, as soon as it became available with our healthcare system, Donald's psychiatrist asked if we'd be willing to take part in a test for it. It's a DNA test to see what medications will best suit your DNA profile. And Donald did that, and it really helped us figure, okay, if he's got a cold, he can have this. If he's feeling depressed, he can have this. If he's feeling like he's been a little too unable to focus, he can try this. And right now he's not on anything except for the Motrigine, which turns out to be obviously the right fit for him. But that guide is so amazing because that
That's
helps you
wonderful.
get around the trial and error of it all.
That's wonderful. And there are other resources I just want to share with the audience. There is the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, which you mentioned, and that web address is dbsalliance.org. Of course, there is the National Association of Mental Illness. Their address is nami.org. And there's the JED Foundation, JEDFoundation.org. They are a national nonprofit and they do a great deal of work with teens and young adults. They're certainly in the colleges helping to deal with young folks who are dealing with depression. They have a number of mental health and substance abuse and suicide prevention programs. Penelope, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today here on Mind Talk. Again, the name of the book is Homeostasis: The Journey of a Manic Depressive. It is co-authored by Donald Rodriguez and Penelope Rodriguez. And Penelope, would you give us your website?
Yes, it is www. dot Donald DONALD hyphen Penelope PENELOPE Rodriguez RODRIGUEZ.com. And thank you for all that you do.
Oh, thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. All the programs are archived at the Mind Talk site under the day on which they air. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk, so do send an email to me at Pamela, PAMELA, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.